from the National Urban League. This is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy and social issues affecting communities of color. I'm your host, Don Cravens, Senior Vice President of Policy and Executive Director of the Washington Bureau.
And I'm Kim Atterbury, Senior Director of Communications and External Affairs.
On this week's episode, we're discussing gentrification, how we can preserve our communities while ensuring economic development. Our guests are Urban League of Greater Washington CEO, Mr. George Lambert, and Dr. Derek Musgrove, who is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and author of Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. But before we begin, a message from Mark Morial, President and CEO of the National Urban League.
I'm Mark Morial, and this is your To Be Equal moment. In the battle over immigration, the largely Latino dreamers, those young people eligible for deferred action for childhood arrivals, have been the face of the discussion. But there are nearly as many undocumented black migrants, including many dreamers, whose fate hinges on a resolution of DACA and other immigration programs. This administration has terminated temporary protected status for seven nations, five of which are predominantly black, including Haiti. Negotiations to protect the dreamers seem to pit groups of immigrants against one another. UndocuBlack Network, an advocacy group headed by undocumented black immigrants, recently organized an act of civil disobedience outside of House Speaker Paul Ryan's Capitol office, demanding that Congress provide a path to citizenship for dreamers without diminishing visa programs that protect black immigrants. We cannot allow black immigrants to be forgotten or sacrificed in this discussion. According to the census, 4.2 million black immigrants are living in the United States. Of those, roughly 620,000 are undocumented. A majority of black immigrants arrive here through family reunification visas or through the Visa Diversity Lottery Program, both of which the Trump administration wants to slash or eliminate. Thanks to a recent ruling by the United States Supreme Court, DACA recipients will now be able to continue to renew their study and work permits until the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has heard their case. There have been no such reprieves for the 300,000 immigrants whose protection under TPS is being revoked. But a group of Haitian and Salvadoran immigrants is suing the administration, accusing that the decision to end TPS is based on race, evidenced by Trump's appalling comments about Haiti, El Salvador, and other African nations. As Americans, we are proud to call ourselves the land of opportunity. Those who choose to be American are no less patriotic than we who are American by birth. As we debate the question of who should stay and who must go, we are obligated to remember our brothers and sisters from Africa and the Caribbean. Black immigrants are dreamers too. I'm Mark Morial, and this has been your To Be Equal moment.
So today we're discussing gentrification, and Kim, as you know, in just about in every urban American city, when you bring up the issue of gentrification, it invokes angst and disgust, and people are angry that it seems like many African Americans are being displaced from their neighborhoods or displaced from their communities and moved out to the suburbs, and other people are moving in.
Right, right. And I think it's a particularly contentious topic for us as an organization because, as our listeners know, we're a civil rights organization dedicated to the economic empowerment of people of color. And we fulfill our mission partly through housing, making sure there's affordable housing for people, giving people access to home ownership. So when we see gentrification happening in communities across the country, there's a rub there. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a rub on how do you make sure people continue to grow and thrive in these communities, their businesses continue to grow and thrive while also taking part in the economic development that's happening.
Right, because black people want the brand new Whole Foods
we want
and
the
grocery stores. Yeah, we want the new new too. But it seems like you can't get the new new without getting kicked out. And somebody else, the new neighbors have to come in too.
Right. So it begs the question, how do you do this responsibly? How do you preserve communities for the people who have long been there while ushering in new stuff, economic development, jobs, businesses, you know, restaurants, shopping.
Right.
You know.
And today we got we have two guests who are DC natives, and they're going to talk about what's going on here in the District of Columbia. But as we will talk about, I'm sure this is not just happening in the District of Columbia.
It's happening everywhere. It's happened in Brooklyn, where I grew up. It's happening in Inglewood. It's happening, I think, in some parts of Atlanta. It's happening everywhere. But I think what makes DC unique, which is why I think we're focusing on DC, is DC historically is an African American city. There are very few cities across the nation where the entire city was African-American majority. And now that's no longer the case.
Right. So I think it's going to be interesting to hear these two gentlemen talk about it, because you're right. I was even in Denver recently, and in Denver, the African-Americans, the part of town that African-Americans was the historically rich part, is no longer looking the same. But that's a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
In D.C., it's almost an entire city.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I want people to stay tuned. This is going to be, I think, a great show. Two great, great interviewees that we're going to have today.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So thank you both for joining us today. Dr. Musgrove, for those who may not be familiar with the concept, what is gentrification? Can you map its origin for us?
Yes, absolutely. Gentrification is a term that began to circulate in Great Britain, specifically London, in the 1970s. And it was used to explain a process whereby well-to-do people went into a neighborhood that was run down, where primarily poor people lived, and decided to buy up the homes and displace them, essentially. It was a race-neutral term coming out of London, and it sort of hops across the pond roughly in the mid-1970s. Now, the actual phenomenon of gentrification, or what we came to call gentrification, is much older. Just here in Washington, D.C., you see what people call private revitalization happening in Georgetown as early as the 1920s, and it sweeps across the city. Until by the 1970s, it's happening roughly in all of the old city. And that's the moment when the Washington Post first runs the word gentrification to describe what's going on in the city.
I want to ask both of you gentlemen, how does it happen? I know, Mr. Lambert, you've been a CEO of several Urban League affiliates, but you're a DC native. And even before the episode, you were talking about the fact that where your office is now, the Urban League of Washington is now, you grew up within the block, and it looks very different now today than it did when you were growing up. And so I'll ask both of you, how does gentrification generally happen?
So you're absolutely right. It is a very different neighborhood than the neighborhood I grew up in. So, you know, I've always said that those who've been part of the fabric of the city should also have an opportunity to be part of the reinvestment and the redevelopment of the city. And that in itself is the challenge. So gentrification a lot of times happen because of disinvestment or in some cases disasters. Now, I know we're focusing on Washington, D.C., but you take, for example, what happened in New Orleans in terms of Katrina. That was a disaster. That really kind of opened the door in what we now kind of look back on as a really kind of gentrified community. So disinvestment, you know, when folks certainly, you know, get pushed out or move out and new people come in. I mean, it's those kind of things that occur in terms of creating an environment for gentrification.
Mm-hmm. Doc, how does it happen?
Well, you know, it happens in a number of ways. One of the preconditions you have to have for the gentrification that we know of today is government disinvestment in certain neighborhoods. Now, if you're looking specifically at Washington, D.C. or any major American city, you'll notice that there is systematic disinvestment in black neighborhoods in particular. Those neighborhoods over time become poor, whereas there's a systematic investment in white neighborhoods, typically through Federal Housing Administration loans, real estate agents valuing those neighborhoods more, government treating those neighborhoods better, giving them better paved roads, lights, and that nature. And what you end up getting is tremendous wealth inequality. That wealth inequality then, you know, as you have a situation where there is gentrification, you end up most of the people who are able to buy properties up in a poor neighborhood and flip them. And most of the people who are displaced by that process, most of the ones who are wealthy are white, most of the ones who are displaced are black. And the basic idea is that, you know, a neighborhood is gentrified when people with money decide that they want it. Prior to rent control laws, which in many cities don't show up until the post-World War II period. In Washington, D.C., they don't show up until the 1970s. If you want someone's apartment, you go and take it. You tell them to move out. After rent control laws, you see something slightly different, and that is that building owners tend to make life very uncomfortable for renters, denying service, denying repairs, making it so that they don't really want to be there anymore. That's the stick. In certain cases, they just give a carrot and they say, look, I'll give you a couple $1,000s if you move out. And so that's how you see it happening.
And so are these primarily local investors or are these foreign investors that's driving gentrification in the city, in these cities?
So it matters. You know, gentrification through the 60s in D.C. is a local phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Typically, because it's Washington, D.C., you'll get local investors who have moved here from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Come to work in the State Department or one of the New Deal agencies. Come here to work for a Defense Department or something, and they'll come and buy a house. They want in-town living. Starting in the 70s and 80s, you start to see people from out-of-town investing who are not moving here, so just banks from out of town. Folks from like Texas and California, mm-hmm. where big money is being made during the 70s. This latest round of gentrification that we've had in the last 20 years, though, has actually seen some more far-flung investment. Typically, foreign investment goes into office buildings downtown.
Okay.
But what you'll see with some of the larger condo developments that have been creeping up from downtown towards some of the neighborhoods is you'll start to get foreign investors as those projects get bigger. But typically, there's a point man of a local developer.
So the other side of gentrification, oftentimes we don't like to talk about it because we do think about it in terms of race. Mm-hmm. But there is also the economic side of gentrification as well. And it was interesting. I was in a conversation one night with several folks, and we were kind of talking about it. And a gentleman said to me, well, you know, the building that I live in, he said, it's a condo, and, you know, probably cost you about $1.5 million to get in. And most of my new neighbors now, they're not folks that look like me. He was white. He said, they're not folks that look like me. They're folks that look like you, pointing to me. And so that really kind of, you know, certainly pulls out the economic side. Oftentimes, I don't say often, but sometimes it's not just race and it's not just us. It really depends on if you have the means, the economic means, to certainly purchase a property. And, you know, so when I look out my window at my office, I see that the neighborhood that I grew up in has really changed in terms of race. What I can't oftentimes decipher and spot out from that is who is walking down the street that may look like me, but it's also part of the gentrification process as well.
Dr. Musgrove, you said something about the recent gentrification that has occurred over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about that gentrification because I think that's, you know, those of us who are not historians, we're looking at that gentrification. We're seeing it absolutely. All over America.
Yep. Yeah.
I told you I was in Denver last week, and even there, people were complaining about the fact that the African-American community that once was is moving out now towards the airport and being sent to the suburbs.
And even in your own experience, the story you told me last week where you met a young white couple and they...
Yes, here in D.C., yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I met a young white couple here in D.C. and I said to him that my wife and I had moved to Prince George's County because we were, mm-hmm. you know, it was getting harder and harder to live in the city. He said, well, mm-hmm. my husband and I just moved into D.C. On Georgia Avenue by Howard University. Isn't it interesting that we're moving in and you're moving out?
Yeah.
But let's talk about the last 20 years, because another phenomenon that has occurred in the last 20 years is we've got more African-American elected officials mm-hmm. in many of these cities that we are saying are being gentrified. What responsibility... or blame, I mean, because I want to be devil's advocate here. We've had black mayors and black city councilmen and women in this city and in many of the cities we're talking about. What can they stop this from happening? Should they have stopped it from happening? Was this happening and they didn't know? Was this happening and they couldn't stop it? I mean, can we talk about that a little bit? What responsibility do our elected officials play in the gentrification issue?
So I mean, I'll start with a point that you made earlier, which I think is critical to underline in this conversation, particularly fourth wave gentrification, but even some of the third wave gentrification in the 70s and the early 80s before the crack epidemic hits, is actually the product of a really great development, which is the desegregation of the suburbs. And so one of the reasons that you have empty space in some of these low-income communities is that black folks with means can move out. And in D.C. in the 80s and 90s, you see black folks leaving at a tremendous rate. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, And if you look at where they're all going to Prince George's County. When you're talking about Washington, D.C., there was a figure in the early 1990s where 80% of the black people in Prince George's County were from D.C., right? And so that is, to a certain degree, a product of the success of the Fair Housing Act of 1968. On the flip side, we made a point earlier talking about the fact that, you know, race and economics sort of come together in gentrification. And the fact of the matter is that far more black people are poor than are whites, right? And that's because of the way in which resources have been allocated in this country. And so with that enormous wealth gap, there's going to be large numbers of black people who can't make the move to the suburbs, whether they want to or not. They can't do it financially. And those people are the ones that are in these inner city communities where when, either for economic or cultural reasons, people with means want to go get a house, those folks are potentially going to be displaced. And as you pointed out, that some of them some of the people displacing poor African Americans can in fact be African American. The numbers are smaller because we have less collective wealth, but nonetheless, that is possible. The reason it happens in this fourth wave is because of a couple of factors just coming together in this bizarre way. One is that cities are safer after 2000. The crime epidemic ebbs, the murder epidemic ebbs. Between 1990 and 2000, the murder rate in D.C. drops by half. Right? I mean, we go from the murder capital of the nation to having about 230 murders. And it goes down by half again in the next 10 years by 2010. So the city's just safer. The second thing is really this sort of cultural change, right? Which is that there is a desire among a lot of folks in the suburbs to abandon the energy wasting, gas guzzling, sitting in traffic being car culture of the suburbs. And so large numbers, particularly of millennials, young people, don't want to grow up where their parents raised them. They want to come back and have some city living. And I celebrate that, right? I mean, because, you know, the abandonment of the cities by much of the white middle class is one of the reasons that those cities declined. And so, you know, you also see this situation where people just want to be back in the city. And they can because it's safer, right? And so when these folks come in, though, they still displace poor folks.
So, but let me just take another minute or so to kind of unpack the crime piece, because I do think that's very interesting. And you're absolutely right. Crime has gone down. I mean, you know, the statistics really kind of bear that. What happens, though, with a lot of folks who really cannot afford to leave the city or at the end of the day, you know, really kind of pushed out, they become hostages in their own neighborhoods. Meaning that many of the newcomers who move into the city then are really kind of pushing on our law enforcement forces in the city to really kind of do more monitoring of the neighborhoods. So you may see some guys who are sitting out playing chess or checkers. Well, they become a bit suspicious. Folks who've lived in the neighborhood for 20 years, they become suspects in their own neighborhoods. So, yes, crime has gone down. But when you really kind of, you know, measure that against, you know, what are some of the other things happening in terms of why that crime is going down? So, and I do want to get back to the first part of your question regarding what are some things that could be done. Councilmember Anita Bonds, who really kind of chairs the Housing and I think Development Committee for the city. So one of the things she has done is move forward on some legislation, really kind of putting a cap on rents at this point. And so that's a good thing. You know, we've got about 80,000 folks who are in the city and, you know, in kind of rental spaces or whatever. So that is a good thing, really, to kind of cap it for the moment. But again, we still have, you know, a really a major challenge in the city in terms of just people who really want to be able to stay here.
And so, and I know neither of you are on the city council here in the district or are mayor yet, but I gotta believe that there has to be some responsibility for these council members. And I'm glad to hear that one of the council members here in the district is doing something. But is it too little, too late? And if you can't answer that question, I get it. I mean, I
apologize for not answering it.
No, it's okay. I just think black people are looking at their black elected officials and saying, you, from a moral standpoint, you should be doing something about this. But even from a political standpoint, Dr. Musgrove, some of these black elected officials will not have a job the next election cycle because their base is now in the suburbs.
Well, no, let me answer directly because I just got carried away with other stuff. So the first thing I should say is that elected officials in this city, black and white, have attempted to address this issue intermittently since the 70s. One of the first things that the Home Rule City Council did in 1975, and so this is right you know, when they began meeting for the first time, is they passed rent control. That was one of the first bills that they passed. Soon after, they passed a moratorium on condominium conversions, where people were flipping apartment buildings into condos, kicking out all the poor people, selling them to young professionals. By 1978, and all of this, I should point out, is happening in response to widespread, raucous, and serious citizen protest on the street. Folks are protesting a lack of heat by landlords who are trying to kick them out by building bonfires in the middle of the street up on 18th Street and Adams Morgan, right? They're holding rent strikes. They're suing their landlords, right? One of the biggest cases comes off of Seton Street. Johnny Barnes, Walter Fauntroy's old chief of staff, it's one of the first cases he tries out of graduate school, where he sues a developer on behalf of renters on Seton Street right at the foot of Adams Morgan, suing to get them to be able to stay in their homes. Right. And you get on the back end of all of this activity, the Tenants' Right to Purchase, Tenants' Opportunity to Purchase Act, and an anti-flipping tax. The city actually taxed property at a much higher rate if you tried to flip it in the city, starting in, I think, 1980. Right. And what you had in that period are the two things that you have to have for poor people to stay in place. The first is that people organize on the ground to force elected officials to pass the laws that they can use to stay in place. Second thing is you have people organizing on the ground to be able to use those laws. Because poor folks, when they look to use one of these laws, like the tenant's opportunity to purchase, they need to organize a huge number of people who aren't necessarily, who don't necessarily know each other, who don't necessarily speak the same language. They need to hire a lawyer. They need to find low interest loans and someone who can actually manage all the economic transactions. All of that costs money. And typically, when you have a bunch of active housing activists out there in the city, you can do that. We don't have that movement environment like we did in the 1970s. And elected officials in this city have not, by and large, stepped in to fill the void when people on the street haven't been doing that in the same way. So a lot of tenants' rights activists had to fight on without robust support from the city council. The laws are still there. They've even passed a couple more. But it's not enough to deal with the amount of wealth that's pouring into the city in the last 20 years. And so people are still being displaced.
You know, so one of the reasons oftentimes folks relocate into the city is the convenience of public transportation. So a bit of a history footnote. So when the metro system was really being brought to D.C. and put into D.C., it was a system initially to bring folks into the city very quickly and then take them out of the city very quickly. It was not necessarily a system being proposed to move people around in the city. And that was during the time when Walter Washington was the first mayor here in the city then. And Walter Washington really had the veto power in terms of that he had to sign off on the approval of the system, metro system here in the district. Walter Washington refused to do that, and he refused to do it unless there was a system, unless there was a rail that would move folks around in the city, and that in itself became the Green Line. Now, fast forward to where we are today. All of the folks in the city, had it not been for the Green Line, but that was really Walter Washington. So oftentimes, I agree, you know, we have to really kind of think through these initiatives and these policies when we put them in place, you know, broader than just the immediate time that we're in, but really for the long run as well. Yes, so I really give Walter Washington a lot of credit. A lot of folks don't know that, but a bit of a history note, if you will.
Yes, sir.
So one of the things that we haven't quite touched on yet, which is a pillar that's very important to the National Urban League, is affordable housing.
Yeah.
How has gentrification affected affordable housing? First, you, Mr. Lambert.
So, you know, we've had a very longstanding partnership with the District of Columbia, and more particularly with the District of Columbia government, the Department of Housing and Community Development, and pretty much the management of the HPAP program, the First Time Home Buyers program. Last year, 265 families became homeowners through that program. And so, you know, I don't necessarily like to throw numbers out because, you know, what I'm always asking behind a number like that is, well, what is the impact of that number? And the impact of that number is that we changed the net worth, okay, of 265 families. We're now kind of adding to the tax base, if you will, of the District of Columbia. And so, you know, because when oftentimes elected officials, members of council, they look at it, they're also looking at the growth in terms of the tax base as well. So, you know, we're partnering, as I always say, to really do our share to ensure that folks who really want to continue to be a part of the fabric of the city will certainly have an opportunity to do that. So the HPAP program, the first-time home buyers, we've been doing for a number of years. I'm very pleased and proud of the work that we do there to ensure that, you know, residents can stay in the city. The other thing, quite frankly, though, is we've now really put more of a target on senior citizens, because, you know, our senior citizens oftentimes are the most vulnerable folks in our communities. Mm-hmm. My wife and I were leaving the Howard Theater one night and bumped into a couple that she knew growing up in the city, and we're talking about, and I wrote about this in one of my articles, was talking about a lady who had purchased a home, her and her husband, many years ago, probably 30, 40 years ago. Husband deceased, she sold the home, got $150K for it, okay? Developer bought it, and then about 6 to 7 months later, put it back on the market for over $700K.
Right.
I was outraged by that.
Right.
Not so much that, you know, kind of the economic side of the opportunity for the developer, but it what bothered me was that we need to do more in terms of educating our seniors. So, for example, was there a family member that could have stepped in to help to, you know, certainly navigate that situation a bit more? Or, in fact, if you're really compelled that you're going to sell, then certainly, you know, let us help to develop some intelligence around what the market is really worth. You know, she sold at 150, maybe we would have pushed her to about 300 or 400K, mm-hmm. because that's what the value of her property was really worth. So really kind of putting a spotlight on the seniors, ensuring that if, you know, they're really pushed to move, they cannot no longer, you know, navigate in the space that they're in, then certainly, as I said, providing an opportunity that they have some real intelligence around it.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Musgrove, we're going to talk about your book. We talked about your book at the beginning of the episode. We'll talk a little bit about it at the end. But in your book, do you get a chance to talk about some solutions and how important is it to invest in some of our lower income communities?
Yeah, goodness, yes. We talk about a bunch of solutions. A lot of the solutions bubble up from renters and poor folks themselves who are fighting to stay in place. DC has a huge cluster of low equity cooperatives, particularly in places like Adams Morgan and Columbia Heights, because that was a way that poor people could form a tenants association, utilize existing pro-tenant laws to purchase their buildings, and then hold them as low equity cooperatives. And the benefit of that is that even if those folks leave and sell, the buildings remain low income. And okay. So you don't diminish the low income stock. That does not, however, address the enormity of the problem. And one of the problems is that, you know, much of the housing in DC is in the private market, right? It's not controlled by the government. It's not federal projects. And what you see during gentrification is essentially developers and people with money gobbling up low-income units in the private market and then turning them into high-income units. And so you diminish the overall number of low-income units in the city. And that's what the city has really been struggling with. Now, the city has attempted on at least one occasion to create a large-scale program that would address the low-income housing shortage. That was the New Communities Initiative created under Anthony Williams. Anthony Williams faced a really bizarre 8 years in the Wilson building. When he got into the mayor's office, the city was hemorrhaging, particularly black middle-class folks. And one of the things he realized is that if we keep hemorrhaging people who have money, we're not going to be able to pay our taxes, because if you look at it, you know, 60% of folks who were working in the city at the time headed out to the suburbs. Mm-hmm. We couldn't tax their incomes. 40% of the land in the city, because of universities and whatever else, is not taxable. It's off the rolls. And so the only way that you could get more tax money and to keep us in the black and not go back into bankruptcy like we had just been in the years prior to his mayorship was to get rich people to move back. So he announces in 2003, I'm going to bring 100,000 middle-class families back to the city. And it's such a preposterous idea that the Washington Post makes fun of him in the paper itself, right? They say, try a really big magnet, Tony. But because he does it right when the housing boom takes off, because he does it right when the city becomes much safer, he's able to get those numbers and more. And so he starts off his mayorship begging people to come to the city. Within just a couple of years, at the height of the housing boom, poor people are knocking down his door saying, Mayor, we are being pushed out of the city. So he sends city manager Robert Bob over to a cluster of housing projects right along North Capitol Street above Gonzaga, which the city dubs Northwest One. And they try out a new program called the New Communities Initiative. And the idea of New Communities is that you're going to rebuild the space so you get nice housing for poor people. but you do not displace them while you're building. And so you have a one-for-one replacement. Nobody gets kicked out and then gets to move back. You build something new next to their current building, then you knock down the building, right? You also invest a tremendous amount in the social capital of the community. So you not only have gleaming new towers, but you also have resources for poor people to be able to work their way into the middle class. Okay. And Bob works this out with all of these tenant associations, right? These really fierce, you know, women primarily who are making sure their community doesn't get wiped off the map. And it's all set to go. Adrian Fenty gets elected and basically breaks faith with the people that they had negotiated this deal. And so New Communities collapses. And the idea was to expand New Communities all over the city. There were going to be six sites around the entire city, right? This was going to be DC's effort to show folks that they could create new housing for poor people in a gentrifying city without displacing anyone. And the Fenty administration muggles it.
Yeah.
Flat. You know, now there is an effort now around the bridge project in Anacostia, yeah, where the folks who are working on the bridge project have literally drawn a 1 mile circle around the bridge on both sides of the river. And they've tried to figure out how they can help poor people in that 1 mile circle because they know that the development itself will generate gentrification. Right. And so they are looking to find ways to create land trusts, low income, low equity cooperatives, whatever else they need to help poor people stay in place. And I encourage people to watch that experiment to see if it can work and to support them in any way they can.
So around the country, we've seen where developers come in and they develop these new condos and they develop these new luxury rental apartments, and they're allowed to develop these structures as long as they agree to set aside a portion of those units at below market value for low income or lower income residents. And in here in DC, it's called affordable dwelling units. Mm-hmm. Is this a good strategy to address affordable housing shortage that's been created as a result of gentrification?
So let me start on that. I think because this dovetails into what you raised earlier about what you know our elected officials are doing. So I will give credit to our mayor, who's really kind of put in place the housing fund and to raise $100 million in the housing fund to really kind of reinvest into our communities at this point. And I think that's really kind of the idea. What are the things that as you asked your question earlier, what are the things that are being done to really offset or really to avert, you know, a lot of this at this point? And I think this year in the budget, as the council move forward, we will actually see those dollars there that they are in place and now really begin to invest them on various projects. I will also add on this, you know, poor folks in many of these communities are getting much wiser now in terms of oftentimes the language that we, you know, that's cloaked in terms of gentrification. Because, you know, when I move around, I hear folks saying, well, you know, yeah, gentrification, and it's being called this. Well, it's what is really, you know, to some extent, urban renewal or redevelopment or the project that you, you know, mentioned earlier as well. So folks are really kind of raising the question now, you know, is this another form of gentrification that's really being, you know, called something else? So you have to really be very careful now because, you know, I'm like, wow, folks are really kind of understanding it and are raising those kind of questions.
You both have talked about two different mayors here in the district, one that embraced, one that didn't. And I think it shows that these elections, these local elections are very important. I mean, we're going to talk about voting in another podcast, but when people ask, why does my vote matter? For in a local election, this is just another issue of why the votes matter, who the mayor, who the council person is for your district, these economic development, these economic interest and investments in our community. You talked about it, Dr. Musgrove, one mayor making a decision and the other mayor not following suit and changing the whole strategy. That made a difference for this district, for this city. And it's a decision that we are continuing to see in 2018, years later.
Well, we're seeing that being played out on the national scene in terms of our national politics as well.
Right. Elections matter. So, yeah. Elections matter. I was smiling, Mr. Lambert, when you were talking about even the name changes, right? It's interesting how a community, even in my small town where I grew up in Louisiana, small city, now the African-American, it used to be the north side of Lafayette, Louisiana, and now it's Upper Lafayette, right? Because when other folks wanted to move there, Upper Lafayette just sounded so much much, you know, more palatable than the North Side, which because the North Side had a reputation, and it was we gotta how do you get rid of that reputation? That part you were talking about, North Capitol, that's NoMass now, isn't
Noma.
It? Noma. That's yes. Right. It's North
I've
Massachusetts.
I've been displaced from Noma personally. I'm in PG County now, but there's an effort actually to rebrand PG County where they no longer want folks to refer to as PG County. It's Prince George's
yes.
County.
You heard I did say Prince George's.
Yes, yes, yes. Prince George. And the mall is now the Mall of Prince George's to PG Plaza.
I have been corrected when I said I moved to PGC. No, you moved to Prince George's.
But you know, the other thing I will add is that so when communities are gentrified, there's not only an impact on the residents that are living there, but we haven't really touched on the businesses that are impacted as a result of it as well. Because the residents who are there and the few, let's say, that get, you know, have an opportunity to stay, what happens with them is that the little shop or the neighborhood store they used to have an opportunity to walk down to,
it's no longer there.
And then what is there, they cannot afford.
That's right.
Okay?
Right.
So it's all about, you're being held hostage in your own neighborhood.
That's right. The barbershop's closed because the clientele is now in Prince George's County with Kim, right? And I mean, no, those businesses matter. And those businesses are the ones who create jobs. That's what helps us with our unemployment rate in African America. Is it just black neighborhoods that get gentrified? I mean, it seems like we're talking primarily about African American neighborhoods. Or is that just a coincidence because we tended to move to the urban areas? Do you see Asian neighborhoods being gentrified or Latino neighborhoods being gentrified?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. D.C. has both of those examples. If you look at Chinatown, starting in the 1960s, Chinese developers who had since moved out to the suburbs, Asian Americans in the D.C. area didn't have to worry like African Americans about being excluded from the suburbs. They also weren't shunted into black schools. They attended white schools in the D.C. area, largely because the population was so small and whites felt that they were relatively non-threatening. So they're heading out to the suburbs and Chinatown is withering. And so they start hooking up with big developers, big white developers, and just saying, well, let's turn Chinatown into a cultural destination. And the poor Chinese that, live there probably won't be able to afford to stay, but such is life, right? Those plans took a while to put into place. It took roughly about 30 years from the time they first came up with them. But today, there are roughly 300 Chinese people in Chinatown. Almost all of them live in two Section 8 apartment buildings because there's no place else in Chinatown that they could live. There's a couple of buildings that businesses still own, but they can't contain people. And so, Chinatown is really a harbinger of what was going to happen around the rest of the city if you looked at the plans going through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And Adams Morgan is struggling with the same thing. I mean, one of our most diverse areas of the city has, good concentration of Ethiopians, Salvadorans, for a time, Vietnamese. And a lot of those people were pushed out by gentrification. Now, the benefit is that large numbers are still there, largely because of that tenant organizing that I spoke about a moment ago. But if they weren't able to buy their apartment buildings, then they wouldn't be there now. And so it's only because of that movement organizing and the city's help that many of them are still there today.
And again, we're talking about the district, but there are people listening who are shaking their heads. Mr. Lambert said the same thing is going on here. The same thing's going on here.
So we talked about folks being displaced to the suburbs. Can you give insight on what's happening in the suburbs? Are the suburbs able to adequately receive these residents that are being displaced? Like, for instance, here in D.C. and folks are moving out to PG County or further into Maryland or Virginia. What's happening there?
So my sense is I'm sure that the suburbs are challenged. We do have a satellite operation in Prince George's County. And, we, in selecting that site, purposely made sure that it was on a transportation route because there's less public transportation in the counties, okay?
Right.
So that's, so that's kind of the first reality or the real shock when you're displaced into the county. You realize you cannot walk out of the front door and walk down to the corner, and there's a Metro bus that you can get on. And if there is a bus, the timing of it is certainly, very different than it is here in the district. So that's, that's a major issue. That's a challenge. County Executive Sharon Baker, would probably say to some extent as well that, they didn't necessarily, at least in the initial, on stock of this, that they didn't initially really have an idea in terms of what the impact would be with regard to their resources and as they looked at doing their budget. And I'm sure now they've, you know, kind of more prepared for that. Mm-hmm. But it is a major shock when folks are pushed out and then having to look at how they can really rely on whatever public resources, you know, are at their disposal in the counties.
Yeah, you know, the counties surrounding D.C. are some of the most affluent in the country. And so they have a good deal of resources to deal with social and economic problems. But what you see happening since the 1990s is that, you know, you get middle-class African-Americans moving out to Prince George's County. You start to get the Latino population moving its center from Mount Pleasant up into Montgomery County, parts of Prince George's County. And as gentrification really takes off in the early 2000s in D.C., working class and then poor people end up following their richer counterparts mm-hmm. out into these counties and recreating some of the problems that we would associate with the inner city of the 1980s and 1990s. Counties have a good amount of money to deal with some of those problems, but nonetheless, you know, the cities are to a certain degree exporting their poverty, and the counties now have to figure out how to deal with that. As for the people themselves, and I think this gets to the point of your question, counties are harder to navigate for poor people than they are for well-to-do people. They're made for cars.
Right.
They're very spread out. And their basic political economy is set up for people who have means. You know, there's not the same density of social service organizations or just, you know, sort of government institutions like public swimming pools, basketball courts, community centers that you can find in the city. And so the counties are having to rush to catch up. In certain places, they're doing a good job. In others, you know, it's the simple layout of the area doesn't allow for, you know, the same response that city governments might have.
So what are residents' best defense? What's their best defense to safeguarding their neighborhoods, their businesses, to ensure that they're not displaced? If they're a part of a neighborhood, that they're able to take advantage of the economic development that's happening in their community, what is that? What does that look like?
With regard to really pushing out access to vote, and the ANCs, for example, you know, the ANCs, particularly in Washington, D.C., have always been a political base that many, if not all, of your city council members will really kind of check in with in terms of the ANC commissions.
Can you explain what ANC is for those who may not know?
Area Neighborhood Councils.
Okay.
But I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. I should have explained that. But that's always been the power, the political base, where members of city council, we can just kind of check in with key community folks. And mm-hmm. So I think this, you know, that's where a lot of this can really be pushed out, and making sure that residents are able to keep elected officials in check or accountable with regard to, you know, what's really happening in our community. That is a very important base. And then, you know, to whatever extent you see things that are really kind of changing in your community, you know, the Whole Foods and some of the other stores, and they begin to start moving, you just really kind of get a sense then that there are some things that are really going to begin to happen in the neighborhood as well.
I would agree. You know, in order to stay in place, you have to be organized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a city like Washington, D.C., you typically get, you know, half the African-American community, maybe a little bit more, that are renters. You know, so they don't have the guaranteed backstop of just saying, get out of my yard. Like, you don't own this.
Right.
And because of the predatory lending in places like PG, that's also a problem, quite frankly, even for homeowners. And so what you have to do is organize. And whether that happens on the Advisory Neighborhood Commission level here in D.C., which is something that folks out in Maryland and Virginia don't have, or at the council level, the county council or the city council level, folks need to demand of their elected officials that they, as renters or as homeowners, have a right to the city or a right to the county. Yep. And what happens is a lot of these developers come in and say, well, don't you want a Whole Foods, or, you know, this is a food desert. And when folks hear that, they should, you know, they should certainly hear those people out, right? You need amenities in any neighborhood, but you also must demand as part of those packages that poor folks are able to stay in place. And a lot mm-hmm. of times here, you know, we talked about the allotment of 10% of units for low income.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the city council will waive it for developers to sweeten the pot. We also have a formula for determining what means low income.
Right.
Well, it starts off with the median income, but this is one of the richest jurisdictions in the country. So if median income is $80,000,
right,
that leaves all of the poor people who make, you know, $30,000, $40,000, sometimes $20,000,
right,
out in the lurch, right? Yeah. Like those units don't even exist for them. And keep in mind that all of that is great if you're building on an open space, you get 10% of units for low income. If you're replacing housing, if you're replacing low-income housing, that means you lost 90% of low-income units.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as a community, folks have to get organized, weigh this stuff, and figure out what's the best deal for them staying in place, knowing at the end that if they are well-organized, they can always say, no, thank you. We'll wait for a better offer.
Yeah. Okay. Whew. This has been... It's been an enlightening discussion, and I know, Mr. Lambert, you have been focused on gentrification here in the district, especially for years, and we are just very, very fortunate and blessed as an Urban League movement, but as people in this community, to have someone like you who's continued to fight the good fight, and in addition to that, do so much for people in housing and in education at the Greater Washington Urban League. I want to thank you for joining us today. And if we want to learn more about the work that the Greater Washington Urban League does, how do we follow you on Twitter?
Twitter, my handle is G Lambert GWL.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Very good. And so thank you for all your work for the Urban League and the service. And Dr. Musgrove, I want to thank you. Your book, I mean, I can't wait to read it. I mean, this was a blessing to have you here as well, because this book falls right in line with today's episode.
I want an autographed copy.
Not a problem.
And the name of that book is Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. And if we want to get more information about the book and about you, how do we find you?
Yes, check us out on Facebook. The title of the book is our Facebook page. You can, of course, look for my bio on the University of Maryland Baltimore County website. And if you want to buy the book, just go to Amazon.com. Or better yet, go to your local independent bookstore, Politics and Prose or Busboys and Poets. You can pick it up there.
Very good. Excellent.
Excellent. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we wrap up this week's episode, we want to recognize an Urban League affiliate for their work to advance our movement. Kim, who are we recognizing this week?
So this week we want to shout out the Urban League of Metropolitan St. Louis, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. We are so proud of the work the St. Louis Urban League does every day to empower and expand opportunities in the city and surrounding communities like Ferguson. We look forward to their continued success. To learn more about the Urban League of Metropolitan St. Louis and their new jobs and training center, follow them on Twitter at ULSTL or visit their website at ULSTL.com.
As always, you can follow us on Twitter at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to listen and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy team here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to the National Urban League's For the Movement.